Sharon's passing out some copies, extra copies of the Eternal Kingdom. We had visitors tonight, so hopefully everybody has a book that's helpful and following along. Mike, I tried to donate a Bengals coat one year, and you gave it back to me. Just joking. But I'm not sure I'd have the courage to wear a Bengals coat right now. Well, you've been better than we are. It's so good to see you tonight. I got a phone call about midnight last night from a young man in New Zealand. And he was calling from the dentist office, and he's going to be having a root canal today. So not everybody can say or want to say they're having a root canal in New Zealand. But so keep Trey in your prayers. So that's, boy, although Ross Perot's dead, that giant sucking sound, I still hear it. So, but anyway, this right here, Archie had mentioned this. We're still taking volunteers now. We're not going to turn anyone away for Saturday and Sunday on passing out this pamphlet right here. And Jeff, I appreciate Jeff making up these copies for us. And he's going to punch a hole through it. We'll be able to hopefully hang these over a doorknob. And no one's going to fight you. No one's going to bite you. You know, if they do, just call 911. And it'll be all right. No one's going to bother you. But let's try to distribute as many of these as we can. And we'll try to invite some folks to our meeting. And you never know. You know, we're not promised the results, but we are certainly responsible for our part, aren't we? So let's do what we can, inviting others to this gospel meeting that we're about ready to have. I want you to go ahead and turn in your books, if you would. Now, it's in the new book on page 95, because I do want to go back a little bit and set the stage. Page 95 in the older books. Lloyd, not sure what that is. There's some of you that have the older copies. Archie has one. It probably is around 93, something like that. I think it was a couple pages.
94, 95.
Okay. All right. Somewhere in there. We'll talk about that in a moment. We have been studying the history of the Lord's Church, and we've primarily been looking at this book, The Eternal Kingdom, that is written by Brother Maddox and McCray. Last week, we were studying Diocletian, and even though Galerius is not in there, we're going to talk about him just a little bit tonight. But I want you to go ahead and turn in your books to page 95. Let's go back and let's revisit this for a little bit, because I felt like last week I was kind of charging through this as quick as I could because I was up against the clock. You see where it says on page 95 from 260 to 303. Someone take two paragraphs for me if they don't mind. Who's got that? Just take two paragraphs for me on that particular. Go ahead, Raymond. Thank you.
Okay. From 260 to 303, there was no persecution or authority of the state. During this period, the church grew rapidly, and many large church buildings were erected. In 284, Diocletian, 304-305.
That's his phone number. Just joking. They forgot to put a hyphen in there. Go ahead.
Assumed dictatorial powers and abolished the Senate that had shared authority with the emperor since Augustus Caesar in 27 BC. With despotic authority, Diocletian began to unify the empire. Under such conditions, it was certain that persecutions would again face the church. Christians had continually spoken out against the idolatry of Roman religion. It was not enough for them to sit by and fail to participate in the public worship. Christianity has in it a militant quality that urges each Christian to share his knowledge and faith with all others. Christians could not therefore submit to Roman religion, but had to speak out against government pressure to make them conform.
So the perfect storm is setting in, isn't it? You have, on one hand, you have the Roman government saying you will worship the emperor. You will worship Roman gods. If not, you're considered an atheist. Okay. obviously the opposite with the Christian is there's no way. You know, we're not going to budge. We're not going to bow down to your gods. And as a matter of fact, you are the atheist. So you see, the perfect storm has set in for persecution against the church. Now, I want you to keep this in mind. By the time, Lord willing, we're finished tonight, this is really going to change. You know, we're going to really do 180. I mean, it's going to absolutely just flip by the time we're finished with tonight's lesson. So keep this in mind as we're reading this. So who wants to read? And it was March 303. Take that and make your way to, I'll read to where it says gradually dissipated. Who wants to read that part? Who's got that? Who has that? Go ahead, Ron. Thank you.
It was March 303 before Diocletian got around to suppressing all religion contrary to that authorized by the government. When the decree came in, it was complete. Christians could no longer hold meetings. All church buildings were to be destroyed. Leaders who were to be imprisoned, and all Christians were to turn in their copies of scripture to be burned. As this edict did not bring the desired result, in April 304, a second decree was issued, which required that all people, without exception, should sacrifice the idols. Any who refused would be killed. Hesibus described this terrible torture that followed. Christians were caused to suffer in every conceivable way. The prisons ran over, and slave labor camps were set up in which Christians were worked to death in the mines. Fortunately for the church, Diocletian abdicated in 305, and the flurry of persecution was gradually dissipated.
Okay, so I know you don't see his name here on that very paragraph, but Galerius is his right-hand man. And Galerius is the one that's encouraging him. His health was very adverse, and he was encouraging Diocletian, hey, you need to step down. You know, you've lost your step. You know, you don't have it anymore. Now, ironically, and you're not going to see this in your books, do a little bit of studying beyond this, that Galerius will get himself later in some turmoil, and he will go back to Diocletian, and he will say to Diocletian, hey, you need to come out of retirement. I need your help. And Diocletian's response was, I'm sorry, I'm enjoying growing cabbages in my garden. That was his response. In other words, no, I'm not. I'm happy with where I'm at right now. Okay. So let's go ahead and finish this out. Additional efforts, and just take that to the top of where it says the Edict of Toleration. Who wants to read that? Go ahead, David.
Additional efforts were made against Christians, but this was the last organized attempt to eliminate Christianity from the empire. Galerius had been associated with Diocletian in persecuting the Christians. After seeing that the persecution accomplished nothing, he issued a toleration edict in 311 that gave security to Christians as long as they did not oppose the peace of the empire. All persecution, however, did not cease until Constantine issued the Edict of Milan in 313. Was granted toleration of all religions in the empire. Throughout the period of persecution, the church continued to grow. It is estimated that by 250 AD, 10% of the people called Christians were in danger of death. All who were insincere were deterred from becoming Christians. The church was able to remain comparatively pure, and the courage with which the truly converted confessed their faith in time of trial made a profound effect on the non-Christians. The Christians have that they were good citizens and obedient to the government in all things and in matters pertaining to God. In matters where God has spoken, they must obey God rather than man.
Okay, and what a powerful way to end that portion of the paragraph. So Diocletian assumed dictatorial powers in 284. In other words, he told the Senate to go pound sand. I'm the man, I've got a plan, I'm in control. That's exactly what he was doing. And the evidence of that was the fact that he asked the Senate to, you know, he dismissed them. He started doing things rogue on his own. He viewed Christianity as a militant group and considered it a threat to unify Rome. Again, he was an old-style, old-school Roman, Diocletian was. We are going to return to the glory days of Rome. And he connected the religion of Rome with the glory days. And the only ones that are standing in the way of that happening are the Christians. That's exactly right. You guys need to stand in line, get in line, and get with the program. That's basically what he's saying. Okay? So, going on, it says, what drastic act did Diocletian embark upon to hurt the church in 303? What was he doing? Burning down churches, right? Right? Burning down churches, placing Christians in prison, burning copies of the scriptures. Okay? Now keep that in mind, because the next, Lord willing, next week, when we get together, now the week after that, guess what will be going on?
Gospel meeting.
Gospel meeting, okay? But Lord willing, next week when we get together, we're going to be looking at the canon, okay? How we got the Bible, okay? And that's, you know, that I think that's a good study that you need to know, as every Christian should know that, okay? Because as you are studying with people and you're talking, well, how do you know the Bible's real? You know, how did we get the Bible anyway? So Lord willing, next week we'll get into that and we'll study that. So, but anyway, here he is. He's burning down churches, church buildings, okay? Christians are being imprisoned. They are burning copies of the scriptures. In 304, Diocletian issued a second decree. And what did it demand of Christians in 304? Do you remember what it did? Bow down and worship these gods. Okay, you're going to do it. Now remember, last week, I mentioned to you that his wife, Prisca, and Valeria, his daughter, they were Christians. Now, what's a guy to do? You know, hey, look, and you know, he had others whispering in his ear. That's what historians say, you know, to pressure him to do this. And he was really struggling with this because his wife is a Christian and his daughters are Christian. That means they'll either have to bow down to these gods or I'm going to lose my wife and my daughter. Unless I can convince them it's okay to compromise your faith. And guess what they did? Yeah, they compromised, didn't they? Okay. They went ahead and they said, hey, look, you know, we'll go ahead and, you know, we'll compromise our faith and we'll bow down to the gods to spare our lives. Okay. What horrific stories did Eusebius share regarding Christians and persecution? You know, we see Eusebius writing about Christians being murdered, sent off to camps, right, and being worked to death. Right? In 305, Diocletian renounced his throne. He became ill. Galerius persuaded him to do this. And Galerius, from 305 to 311, attempted to persecute the Christians, but it had no effect on them. And we begin to see him backing off of persecuting the Christians. We'll talk a little bit about the edict that was developed and came into existence. But at this point, do you have any questions or comments? Any remarks you want to make with what we've read so far? Gary?
Never mind.
You sure? You're good?
Why was it changed to B.C. to A.D.? Where did they come from? Did Rome do that, or who did it?
Oh, the counting?
Yeah. B.C. and A.D.
Right. You see different numerical systems, and you go back and look at Catholicism. You start...
out of context, but...
Yeah. Well, no, that's a good question.
I'm always worried about that.
Right. You know, and it's how they do their numbering system. Okay. Any other questions or any other comments with what we have looked at here? Mike, go ahead.
I think that Daniel, and I thought about it last week, but, you know, Daniel 3, you kind of get the same thing where Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, when you hear all these instruments going off, you know, fall down and worship
down
this
and worship.
Golden image. And,
yes.
And the three friends of Daniel's, you know, they ended up getting marched to the fiery furnace.
Yes.
And, you know, when we hear those in VBS, it makes you feel, you know, really good inside. And that, you know, your faith is strengthened by that.
Right.
But man, this is life or death. I mean, it, you know, the courage to say, That's who we have to be.
Right.
Man, I can't imagine what these folks were going, you know, seeing their mother and daughters and sons' faces. I'm just thankful that we don't today.
Right.
We need to be taking advantage of the opportunity that, you know, we can worship unmolested.
That's,
say that in our prayers a lot.
Exactly. And it is, Mike. It's one of those unthankful, ungrateful blessings that we experience every day that we should be grateful and thankful for. Mm-hmm. And I won't share the story again, but, you know, go rehash it all. But in India, you know, when I was at my friend's house up on his roof preaching the gospel, we went downstairs after I was done preaching and we were done singing songs and worshiping. And he says, "Brother Scott, I'm happy that we had our meeting tonight." I said, "Well, me too." He says, "No. I had Hindus and Muslims calling me all day, threatening my life and telling me to not have you preach because he had passed out flyers throughout the neighborhood." You know, and I said, "Oh, okay." Didn't realize it, but what a blessing that is. Go ahead, Carl.
Well, the Hindus that set against Christian, I've never heard that much resistance from them.
Yeah, he said he had Hindus, and, you know, and it's idol worship, you know.
Yeah.
They're false gods. Yeah.
You hear that from Muslims and even the Jewish.
Right. I don't think they're as aggressive as the Muslims, Carl.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're definitely not in favor of Christianity,
right.
You know, because their gods are divine to them. And that's interesting. I want to tell you guys, you know, animals like cows are gods and monkeys are gods. And when we were driving throughout India, you know, I mean, if cows were walking in the middle of the street, you just had to wait. You couldn't get out and prod them and beat them or anything. They're gods. I mean, it could be Uncle Rajesh, you know. You know, so you have to be careful, you know. So, but you know, that, and again, getting back to what you're saying is the fact that, man, what a blessing it is, you know, to live where we live, you know, and experience the freedom that we experience to worship God unmolested. Okay. Let's go on and let's look at the Edict of Toleration. I want us to, I've got the slide up here, but what I want us to do is, let's go ahead and read this. I have the edict itself, and we're going to put it up on the board here in a little bit, and we're going to analyze it. We're going to go through it together, okay? And I just want to hear from you. If there are things that just jump off the page at you, that's just a head-scratcher. But anyway, let's start reading this. Who wants to read the first big paragraph of the Edict of Toleration? Austin.
The persistence with which Christians refuse to obey the government and worship the idols had finally won toleration for their conviction. There had been a great deal of misunderstanding. The church would have been a blessing to the empire, and the rulers should have recognized that the God of the Christians required obedience to civil law. It was not reason on the part of Galerius, however, that led to toleration of Christianity. It was rather a feeling of shame and inhumanity with a knowledge of the fact that additional persecution would serve no purpose that moved Galerius on his deathbed to issue the Edict of Toleration. After admitting the futility of persecution, he says, "Nevertheless, since many still persist in their opinions, and since we have observed that they are now neither show due reverence for the gods nor worship their own god, we therefore, without our wanted clemency in extending pardon to all, are pleased to grant indulgence to these men, allowing Christians the right to exist again and to set up their places of worship, provided always that they do not offend against public order."
Okay. Austin, you want to just take that next paragraph for me? Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
"We will, in further instruction, explain to the magistrates how they should conduct themselves in this matter. In return for this indulgence, it will be the duty of Christians to pray to God for our recovery and for the public weal and for their own, that the state may be preserved from danger on every side, and that they themselves may dwell safely in their home."
Okay, now this is interesting. Because I told you, we're about ready to do about face, okay? That you were hunted like a dog, all right? You were persecuted. And now all of a sudden, but this is interesting how this is all, this is just worded. Okay, and we're gonna dissect this and break this down in just a moment. But according to our author, what incorrect assumption or miscalculation did the Roman government make about Christianity? He tells you in the first paragraph there. Go ahead.
They claim that they don't worship their own God.
Okay, okay. All right. Anybody else? That's good. That's right.
They were good. It's just a perception that the Christians would be more of a hindrance than a help.
That's right. And you got it, aren't you? Is the fact that, you know, they made the assumption because, like Austin said, you're not worshiping our gods. You're a hindrance to our government because the government, the state, and our God's religion is one, okay? But if they would have truly got to have known who the Christians were, they would have realized we're not anti-government, okay? Now, what passages in the scriptures tell you that we're not anti-government as long as the government is good and is used as an instrument of God to, you know, to protect those who are innocent, to be a blessing to those, and to punish the evildoer. Wait a minute, that sounds like Romans chapter
12.
Okay. Yeah, Romans 13. Okay. But, you know, and look also at 1 Peter, guys, in 1 Peter chapter 2. Let's look at this. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 17. Someone read that for me. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 17. Archie's got it.
Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors as those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put the ignorance of foolish men, as free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice. And one servant to God, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king.
Wow, it's pretty direct. It's pretty. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 2, Paul tells us, hey, prayers and intercessions need to be made for all men and the king. Okay? So if they would have taken time to have gotten to know Christians, you know, it's like, you know, these guys aren't so bad after all, you know? But just because the fact that, hey, they are giving us pushback on worshiping our gods, you know, they must be evil, you know? They must be anti-government, okay? So there was that going on, okay? So keep that in mind. What prompted Galerius to establish the Edict of Toleration? What prompted him to establish the Edict of Toleration? Okay, it's like, you know, go ahead, Austin.
You recognize the persecution of them wasn't working.
It's not working, okay? It's not working. And man, how much blood do you have to spill before it's like, if you got a conscience, this is wrong, you know? This isn't, something's not right about this, okay? Not all Germans persecuted the Jews, okay? Because it was wrong, right? So again, there was something within them. It is said that shame and guilt moved the Emperor Galerius to enact the Edict of Toleration. Now let's stop for a moment. Because sometimes something is right before our very eyes and we read over it so fast, we just miss it. The Edict of Toleration. Who are we tolerating? We're going to tolerate you Christians. Anybody got a problem with that? I've got a problem with the way that's worded. Think about it. Wait, how about the edict of, hey, I'm sorry, we messed up, you know? How about the edict of, we're ashamed, you know? Where's that edict, you know? But you see, the way government is, well, we got to do a little damage control. We got to at least save face. So let's try to save face, and we'll tolerate you, Archie. Go ahead, Amanda.
I think it's very interesting in the last paragraph that says it will be the duty of Christians to pray to God.
Oh, I'm so glad you saw that.
It's like, wait a second. So you don't believe in this, but now you're going to make me do what I already do.
Right. Right.
To benefit you.
Right. 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 So that is a good segue into the edict itself. Let's look at it. As I was, you know, looking at this, and there's two slides of this. If we can go back, I'm assuming if we want to go back and read this. Let's go through this. Now, we'll go through it slow, okay? But here's what I want you to do. I don't want to just blaze through it, okay? I want to go through it slow. And I want you to read this because Amanda hit on something that, you know, we've hit on something here that I think is really interesting, because the way they're spinning this is, you know, you have to think that some Christians were like, wait a minute, you know, the very edict itself, the very title of it. Then you look at the wording of this. This is so I'll read it, we'll go slow, and we'll discuss it. So here it is, okay? Among the other measures that we frame for the use and the profit of the state, it had been our own wish formally that all things should be set to rights in accordance with the ancient laws and public order of the Romans, and to abandon the persuasion of their own ancestors should return to a sound mind. Okay, return to a sound mind, seeing that through some reasoning they had been possessed of so self-willed and seized with such folly that instead of following the institutions of the ancients, which perchance their own forefathers had formally established, they made themselves and were observing laws merely in accordance with their own disposition, and each as each one wished, or it should be as it, and were assembling in with the various intent that they should betake themselves to the institutions of the ancients. Very many indeed were subject to peril, while very many were harassed and endured all kinds of death. So, you know, as we're looking at this, you know, they're trying to figure out, you remember at first they looked at Christians and the Jews as one. The Romans did. They looked at Christianity, and that's why Christians were not so heavily persecuted at first, okay? So they were looked at as one. But now all of a sudden, they are acknowledging the fact, remember, we've looked at this, where, oh, they're not Jews. They're Jewish. They're Gentile. They're their own sect. They're their own cult. They're different than the Jews. What are they doing that for? You know, why are they breaking away from those people for? So they're beginning to acknowledge that, and they're going out and they're assembling on their own, and they're kind of doing their own thing apart from the temple. Christians assembled, and they were assembling in homes. Okay, and you know they were separate from old law Jewish faith. Okay. So they're figuring this all out. Now let's go to the next slide. And since the majority held to the same folly, and we perceived that they were neither paying the worship due to the gods of heaven nor honoring the God of the Christians, having regard to our clemency and the invariable custom by which we are wont to accord pardon to all men, we thought it right, in this case also, to extend most willingly our indulgence. Okay, well, thank you. That Christians may exist again and build. That line got me when I read that. Okay, that Christians may exist again. Okay, that Christians may exist again and build the houses in which they used to assemble, always provided that they do nothing contrary to order. In another letter, we shall indicate to the judges how they should proceed. Wherefore, in accordance with this, our indulgence, they will be bound to beseech their own God for, there it is, our welfare, and that the state and their own, that in every way, both the well-being of the state may be secured, and they may be enabled to live free from care in their own homes. So let's stop. So you started this with that remark, and you caught it. And I'm glad that you did, because I thought, man, that takes guts, you know, to go there. You know, as we're reading this, what are some things that stir within you as you read it? Don?
Well, notice that all of the things about the way they had been injured or killed are kind of in the passive tense. It doesn't say that we killed them.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say that the state killed them.
No ownership.
No, it just says they had problems and...
It's you.
Yeah.
You know, we're the victim, you know? You see the way this works?
And it also represents them as having left the faith of their fathers, drifted off, and now they're going to come back into the right place where they ought to be.
You need to come back to your sound minds. Sam.
What it spoke to me was that if I tolerate your God, and it appears to everyone else that you're not only worshiping your God, but you're also worshiping our God too. And we downplay the significance of your God, and we just jump, throw him in, lump him in with all the rest of ours. So now you're a good citizen because as long as we don't complain, no one else will notice that you have your own God. It looks like you have our gods as well.
You ever feel like you're playing the game with someone, heads I win, tails you lose?
Exactly.
You know, that's what that sounds like. Exactly. You know, heads I win, tails you lose.
Exactly.
You know, Archie.
But they're accusing him of not even worshiping their God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is interesting. Dave.
The first slide. And we're observing laws merely in accordance with their own disposition and each one's wish. So in other words, hey, Christians, you're just obeying laws that you made up.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were obeying laws that God
you rebels.
Created, and the Romans were the ones who were making stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
God's will.
Mm-hmm. So you rebels.
They kind of turned the tables on the first thing.
We'll tolerate you, I guess, you rebels.
You're making up laws that you're following, quote, laws that you created. Mm-hmm. Christians didn't create those laws. God created those laws.
Right.
Against the fact that the men of the government of Rome created laws.
Uh-huh. Correct.
But they're telling, hey, you're doing.
Yeah. It's kind of messed up, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts? I mean, as you read this. Yes. Oh, okay. Follow the bouncing buck.
Right.
This is becoming expensive. Exactly.
All
those taxpayers. Right. Yep. Anybody else? I mean, I just think this is really interesting. Go ahead.
Sorry that you were subjected to this.
But you kind of deserved it.
We're
going to
get you back now.
Right. You know, so we're doing you a favor. You know, we're gonna give you a little pity pass here. Okay. With this edict. Right. Go ahead, Melody.
Was there anything external to the Roman Empire going on at the time that made this a more extreme attack?
Oh, I tell you what. So what you don't see is there's a lot of turmoil that's going on. When we get to Constantine here in a little bit, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces and parts. And there's more than just one ruler behind the scene. There's like little emperors want to be, you know, JV emperors, okay? And so these guys, you know, they're very territorial, okay? And there's a lot of fighting that's going on. So there is a lot of bloodshed. There's a lot of expense that is going on. So there's things that we're not seeing. You know, this is a great book. We're getting a flavor of the gist, okay? But you can do some reading. That book that I shared with you last week really gives you a good picture of some things that are happening behind the scenes. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Austin.
Just talking about the edict of toleration, kind of, if you look at politics even today, you'll rarely find a case where you see a return to center from some extreme position.
Mm-hmm.
I think here you look at Diocletian extremely persecuting the Christians, and then rather than going to a center where the Romans might have seen that as like a moderate level of tolerance or of a moderate level of persecution/toleration you'd see pre-Diocletian, you go, okay, you know, we're done persecuting you in your entirety.
Mm-hmm.
Against what a lot of Roman citizens, I feel, probably would have, I can't imagine that they were all okay with that, given how things had been in the past.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to know what the ideology of the average Roman was towards the toleration of Christians, and if that continued all the way down to your common citizen, or if it was just the government saying, hey, we're not going to publicly persecute them, mm-hmm. but privately they're still going to be treated as kind of third-rate citizens.
It is hard to put hate back in the box once it is unleashed. Okay. And I see where you're coming from. Some of the things I have here is the fact that Christians would be persecuted to give up their religion. Can you imagine such a thing? That Christians would be persecuted to do that? How would you feel if the government decreed Christianity illegal? It's unlawful. That would be an awful thing. And folks, we need to do our dead level best as Christians to ensure the fact that our religious freedom is always protected mm-hmm. in this country. And never take it for granted. Second, the government realizing how they overreached, they overstepped in violating the convictions of Christians, they could now return to sound mind. So, if the Christians can now return to sound mind, what mind were you of when you were persecuting Christians? You know, I mean, think about that, right? If the Christians can now return to sound mind, because they were, you know, they were peace-loving people, you know, what mind were you of, okay? What arrogance on behalf of the Roman government. Throughout the edict, Christianity was considered, here's a word you didn't hit on, guys, folly. We read it twice. Folly. Christianity was considered folly. But now they can return to sound mind again. I'm reminded of Paul's words in 1 Corinthians in chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. That in the eyes of the world, Christianity is considered foolishness. You said it. That's right. Christianity is considered foolishness. Okay. Also, I find it amazing that the government now identifies Christians of sound mind. And we did discuss that. There's one statement that the faithful in Christ could proudly express as they held their head up high. And it is this, and here's my quote that I put down. How can I return to something and someone that I never left in the first place? Shouldn't that be our stand?
Yes.
Now you think about that. How can I return to something or someone that I never left in the first place? See, that's our plea. That's our plea. You may take my life, but you will never take my freedom. As for me, as for you and me, you may kill me for being a Christian, but you will never deny me from being a Christian. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Or William Wallace. But anyway, I digress. You know, I love Braveheart. I'm sorry. That's another inspiring movie to me. So, but anyway, okay, guys, let's move on. And I'm going to try to get through this as quick. Let's read the Edict of Milan. Who's got that? The Edict of Milan. Let's read that real quick and get through that. We got about 7 or 8 minutes. Lloyd, go for it.
Okay. The Edict of Milan, issued by Constantine in 313, not only granted Christians the right to exist, but they are now to be encouraged, he says. We therefore announce that, notwithstanding any provisions concerning the Christians, in our former instruction, all who chose that religion are to be permitted to continue therein. Whoopie-doo. And are not to be in trouble or molested. Moreover, concerning the Christians, we before gave orders with respect to the places set apart for their worship. It is now our pleasure that all who have bought such places should restore them to the Christians without any demand for payment.
Yeah, I told you it's going to do 180 here. Okay. Keep going. So just finish that out for me.
Okay. He then stated that former places of worship that were in the hands of non-Christians should be returned to the Christians without cost, and the owners should make application to the government for their compensation. This is the first government action which was favorable to the church and represents a complete reversal of policy. Instead of confiscation, there is restoration of property. The future of the church looked bright. Actually, there was great danger ahead. with the removal of persecution and the growing popularity, the church was to be perverted and polluted with growing heresy.
And it was.
When we finish,
yes, please do, Lord. You're doing great.
The reason for the victory of the Christians rests primarily in the fact that God was with them. The eternal kingdom could not be exterminated from the earth. The part the Christians had in winning the victory is set forth pointedly by Gibbon when he attributes this success to the pure morals of the Christians. Their inflexible zeal and missionary work, the unity of the congregation, the miraculous powers shown by the apostles and the Christians, hope of eternal life.
Okay, thank you. So remember me telling you earlier that there were emperor want-to-bes, okay? JV emperors, okay? And they ruled over territories. Maximinus is one, Licentius is the other, and Constantine is another one, okay? So what happened is we have Constantine and Licentius form a compact. And and usually whenever, you know, an allegiance is given to another emperor, a daughter or someone is married off. And that's what had happened here. Constantine's, I believe it was his daughter, was married off to Licentius, okay? Because they're going to whack Maximinus. And they did. Okay, so he's out of the picture. When that happens, okay, there was a battle that was about to take place, though, okay, with Constantine. Now, you're not getting this in this book. You got to go external sources and start reading. So, quote unquote, Constantine has been said to be the first Roman Christian emperor, okay? And I say that in air quotes big time, okay, because he was sprinkled. He was never immersed. Okay. So, spoiler alert. Okay. So, but anyway, so looking at this, Constantine is believed to have said that going out to battle, he had seen a vision where he was granted victory. And in his mind, God had given him that message. Okay. And he went off to war and he cleaned house. And he gave God credit for it. And he was favorable to the Christians because of it. Now, I want to put up this last slide so you'll see this. Let's see here. What was so different about the edict as opposed to the edict of toleration is the fact that, man, you know, Christianity's in. Where paganism was a part of the state, guys, now Christianity is. The government and Christianity is one now, okay, because of Constantine. The church would encounter peace instead of persecution. However, heresy was about to impact Christianity. And you begin to see that. Baptism has changed at this point. Archie.
We've said all along that the church will never be destroyed from without.
Right.
The church will be destroyed from
and without. That's a perfect example of this.
That's what you got here.
And here's how favorable Constantine was to Christianity, though, was the fact, I'm going to put this up here. I know it looks like Elvis, okay? Give him some sideburns, but that's Constantine. Okay, and you see that symbol right there? Those are the two first Greek letters in Jesus' name, right there. Okay, that was on their Roman coins whenever Constantine was emperor. You know, so he was all in on Christianity. Okay, as a matter of fact, as far as the Bible goes, he commissioned, Bibles to be printed and distributed. Okay, so there was some bad. Okay, but there's still yet, you got to take some of the good. You still have to take some of that good and say, you know what? I'll take some of that good too, even though because he had a flaw with regards to what he was being taught. This is where the heresy is coming in. Okay, and that's why, guys, it is important. I told you about the time in Portsmouth, Ohio, where I went to a lady's house to have a Bible study, and she says, brother, I'm going to go all the way back, and I'm getting excited. I'm thinking she's going to become a New Testament Christian. She goes, I'm going to go all the way back to the Catholic Church. I said, oh, no, you haven't gone back far enough. But, so that and that and going back in a lot of people's minds, that's what that means. Go ahead, Samantha.
Was he the first person to be sprinkled? Was that a thing before?
I don't think so. I think that was going on, you know, but it was on his deathbed, though.
It was on his deathbed.
You know, it was on his deathbed that he went ahead, because he was said to have been a Christian by Christian authors before, but he was not even baptized. Now, here's how into it he was. You got something to go for it.
Well, I was going
to
say he never gave up his positions in the Roman Church with their gods and idols and things. So he still essentially was that.
Right.
So
yeah. He still identified with the Roman gods, and the Romans identified the emperor, him, as a god, too. He didn't give up that. You're right. Good point. He even had his soldiers march down to the river, his army. That symbol right there, you know, that was on their shields when they would go out to war, okay? He had his soldiers to go down to the river, and he would have them, quote-unquote, air quotes, baptized by effusion, okay? That's not, you know, that's not scriptural baptism, right? But that's what was going on then, okay? And as Paul Harvey says, now you know the rest of the story. Okay, Lord willing, we'll talk about the canon next week. Hopefully you found this interesting and fascinating.